going deep. I feel like Kalo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive, up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
That's right, it is the Going Deep podcast, and I am Donovan Bennett. On this episode, we're going deep on all things auto racing, and if you've listened to this, you probably know that I don't mind me some auto racing. I think it's pretty exciting, and I think the storylines are great. A couple weeks ago, we had a conversation about the series Full Speed about NASCAR. If you haven't listened to it, feel free to go back in our archives and give it a listen after you listen to this. If you're listening to your radio, thank you. Make sure to like, favorite, share, and subscribe the podcast. This time, though, we are going F1. A Canadian Grand Prix wrapped up not that long ago in Montreal. Shout out all of the great celebrities, Canadian celebrities we saw there, like Sarah Nurse and Penny Oleksiak. Not Canadian, but Ben Stiller was in the house. Toronto Raptor Grady Dick was there for the proceedings. Ben Matherin was supposed to throw an F1 party that weekend, but he was a little bit busy. He was in the NBA Finals. But no worries, because F1 isn't going anywhere in terms of leaving Montreal, which I did fear. The Canadian Grand Prix signed a contract extension with F1 through 2035. So there is actually a little bit of change. The weekend it happens will change. It's actually going to move up to May 24 weekend. So if you're planning on getting away to your cottage, well, now you got another opportunity to stay local if you're in the area and see some great racing. And actually, it's going to be on the calendar after the Grand Prix in Miami. So a little bit of F1 housekeeping and news for you there. I'm going to give you some F1 insights now, because I'm going to be joined by Mark Priestley. Mark was a mechanic and pit crew member for McLaren Racing from 2000 to 2009. Would not be a great weekend recently to be in the McLaren pit. But other than that little blip they had, they've been flying. He worked alongside champions like Lewis Hamilton and Fernando Alonso. And he was actually part of the team during Hamilton's rise to his first world championship. And so he can bring us some rare insights into Lewis Hamilton, who I still believe is the greatest driver we've seen on an F1 circuit. Verstappen, truthers, he still has a way to go. But I think what's interesting to me is he can translate some of those lessons that he learned in a high-stakes teamwork environment like F1 and like the garage to our everyday life, our families, our workplaces, where we are all tasked every day to make a bunch of split-second decisions. And some of us are looking to find what elite performance looks like in our own lives and our own industries. He was actually speaking in Montreal during the Grand Prix weekend at Explorance World, talking about these very topics to business leaders here in Canada. And so I'm going to try and get some of that intel from him for you for free. So full disclosure, I spoke to Mark before it was announced that the Grand Prix in Montreal is going to be here for the next decade. But I did get some insight from him on what makes Montreal special. So let's listen to and learn from Mark Priestley on the lessons from the pit lane. Let's go deep. So Mark, the world of F1, so fascinating. You know, obviously incredibly intense, but it brings so many different worlds together, whether it's marketing, promotion, tech and science, industry, community. I'm fascinated when you're on the inside of an F1 team. What are some of the mechanics that really in the paddock, close-knit team, but even when you think of the global brands, a much bigger team, what does communication, partnership, teamwork look like in that high-pressure situation?
Yeah, so it's fascinating. Like you said, I think all of those elements you've just described, a lot of people don't necessarily realize that actually, although it's a sports team and it's a Formula One team, the bit on track is what most people see. There's so much behind the scenes. There's so much going on. And every single facet of what makes a Formula One team, from the business side to the communications, technology, teamwork, all those things you mentioned, they're all at an elite level. And that's what makes Formula One special. Everything is the kind of best, you know, industry standard that it can be. And so, you know, from my perspective of being on the inside of that, it's a real privilege, first of all, to be in amongst an environment where everything is at such high standards. And what that does for you as an individual, as part of that, is that it suddenly changes your perspective. And for me, I worked at McLaren for 10 years. It changes your perspective of what you believe is possible. And what I mean by that is, I believe anything's possible because I've seen it happen. You know, I've been surrounded every single day at work and in my career by elite level individuals in every single role. And suddenly you start to appreciate that there's nothing you can't achieve when all of those people work together. And so what Formula One teams do incredibly well is create an environment or a culture. You know, it's the buzzword, isn't it, in the corporate world particularly, is culture. And I'm here at Explorance World 2025 in Montreal this week talking about the culture inside a Formula One team, because I know that it can help, you know, organizations and individuals in the wider world. So our culture is all about excellence. It's about every single detail mattering. So, you know, if there's one small detail, it matters just as much as the bigger details. Everything matters. If anything matters, it all matters. That's the philosophy inside a high-performing team in Formula One. It's all driven, of course, by an intense competition. If we don't go to those incredible levels, someone else will be, and we'll suddenly get left behind. So the competition drives you, but the need or the desire to be the very best in an already elite group is what pushes the levels to those extraordinary heights that Formula One teams operate at.
So I wonder how decisions are made, because you have lots of people who are in their own roles, making, you know, very important decisions that are going to impact the group. And among all of us, you know, there's a balance of, you know, the artist, where you're creative and you're in flow state, and the scientist who's following, you know, some real steps in order to find a conclusion. How do you, when you talk about culture, delegate, you know, how those decisions are going to be made, and what sort of processes are going to be followed?
Yeah, so the way that I would sort of answer that is that our culture is one where everybody is empowered to be a leader. When I first started at McLaren, we had a very different model, if you like, in that, and this wasn't just McLaren, this was across the board. There was one sort of leader in a team, and that was the team principal. It was the same actually in the sport. If you think about Bernie Eccleston, the guy who used to run Formula One for many years, it was almost a dictatorship. It was one person leading and everyone else following, right? So we used to call that a leader-follower model. Today, what we have, and over the time when I was at the sport, we transitioned into what we now call a leader-leader model. And that means everybody is empowered to be a leader. Even if you don't have the word leader or manager in your job title, the company, the culture, allows you to make decisions, encourages you to make decisions, because we trust in the people that we have employed in our organization. So the leader-leader model speeds up a lot of the process in terms of getting decisions made, because you don't have to escalate everything to another level to go through various kind of committees and meetings. Everyone's empowered and trusted to make the right decisions at each level. Now, of course, you have to have checks and balances with all of that. And we do that amongst the groups of people that work in each department. So we openly allow and encourage people to question those decisions when they're made. That's not seen as a criticism. It's not seen as somebody doubting someone's ability. It's seen as a regular and normal part of the process that a decision should be questioned, because you find things in that scenario that are not quite optimal. And that ultimately is the ultimate goal. The only thing that matters in a Formula One team is getting to the right outcome as quickly as possible. That might be a decision on race strategy, but it could be a much bigger strategic decision in a business sense, for example. The only thing that matters is our performance, our ultimate performance. So whatever route we can find quickest and most efficient to get there is the one we all want. And I think that's the biggest difference, is that everybody is being driven by the ultimate need for performance. There are very few egos inside a Formula One team. There's very few characteristics or personalities that are striving for personal gain over and above the team gain. And that really is the key. That's what our culture in a nutshell delivers in Formula One. Teamwork and the team performance is what matters most. And therefore, to make those decisions, everyone's empowered as long as they're heading towards the same ultimate goal of improving our team performance.
It's funny to hear you say that there are very few egos within a Formula One team, because as an avid Drive to Survive consumer, I've been told that it's the opposite, that team principals have egos, the drivers have egos, the parents have egos. How much of that is, you know, reality TV production, and how much of what we've been consuming is real?
There's a lot of production that goes into Drive to Survive, I have to say. It's an entertainment show. And so a lot of the storylines and narratives are a long way from reality. I mean, having said that, I'm certainly not saying there are no egos in Formula One. There absolutely are. Whether that's sometimes that's drivers, sometimes it's team principals. But I think the difference is that the egos from a team principal perspective that you might see on Drive to Survive tend to be in the sphere of one team principal versus another, if you like, in that regard. Inside their own team, I think it's very rare to find any one individual that thinks they're better than the rest of their own team. They might, you might find a Zach Brown who thinks he's better than a Christian Horner or somebody, in that sense. But that's a competitive element. It's like everybody at McLaren thinks they're better than everyone at Red Bull. That's the competitive nature of our sport. And that's exactly what we're striving to be. So there's an ego, in that sense. But I'm talking about within the team structure. There's no place for egos internally, because it only ever becomes destructive. And, it doesn't get us closer to our mission, to our goal of ultimate performance. So we found ways to eradicate that. And it's a long, slow process. If you want to change the culture, it's what I've been talking about here at the conference this week. If you want to change the culture, it takes time. The leaders have to model it. You have to live it. You have to, display the characteristics you want everyone else to display as well. And it might take years in some cases. But when you've got it, it polices itself, it looks after itself, and it sustains itself. And that's what, that's the holy grail for, I think, any organization. Formula One teams are just a little bit further advanced than many others in that regard.
If you were basing it off of the constructor standings, you can make an argument that everyone at McLaren is doing a better job and is better than everyone at Red Bull right now. You obviously you understand the group really well. They're flying right now. What do you make of the success McLaren is currently having?
Yeah, I mean, as a former McLaren team member, I love it. I commentate these days for the BBC back in the UK, and in that role, I have to be impartial, but it's very difficult because I will always be a big McLaren fan. So, it's lovely to see the guys and girls there having some success, because the reality is there's been a long period of time when they haven't had a lot to celebrate. Certainly externally, the results have not been that great for a long period of time. But if you go back to last season, 2024, on the face of it, and a lot of fans, I think this, if you look at, it was the Miami Grand Prix last year where Lando got his first win. The team got their first win in quite some time. And from that point on, things really switched. Things turned around. They started to put together a championship campaign. And for the second half of that season, they were in a really strong position. It looks like they'd really found something in Miami that had changed their fortunes. But the truth of that is that there was no magic bullet, silver bullet they found in Miami. Those fortunes changed because of 10 years worth of really hard work and building an organization in the background. When I say these culture shifts are not quick fixes, they're not. McLaren 10 years ago were right down the back of the grid and struggling with that Honda engine. If you remember, it was a really difficult time. Everything seemed to be going wrong. But what happened as a result of that was they began to put the right people in the right places. They began to build the organization and build this, the culture that they wanted to have. that's taken a long period of time, chipping away when no one's watching. It's all happening in the background. There's no celebrations externally. No media are writing great things about you whilst all this is happening. They're only seeing the results on track, which were dismal. But in the background, they were gradually edging towards what happened in 2024. So it wasn't a switch halfway through 2024 that got them those results. It was a 10-year or more plan that gradually edged them closer and closer. And when you start to get the good results, you start to learn how to win. You know, you change the mindset of the team from one that's continually losing to one that's having a bit of success. You get a bit more confidence. And all of these little things start to combine together and compound to the point where we are now, where they're operating now incredibly well. They're dominating this season in 2025. It's almost certainly going to be one of those two McLaren drivers that wins the championship. And the team absolutely already have the Constructors' Championship nailed on. It's going to be a great season for McLaren, but it's not been the work of 5 minutes.
You talk about that only drama we have left between which, orange car is going to be P1 and who's going to win the Drivers' Championship. Managing the dynamics between drivers. For me, the only thing I can compare it to is managing the dynamics between the two toddlers I have, where you want them both to feel like they're special, but there's two of them. How do you, in a scenario where there isn't a clear, one and a supporting driver, how do you manage that? Is it possible, and what can we transfer from that to our everyday lives?
Yeah, I have twins, so I totally get you, man. Yeah, it's very difficult. Look, I think it is difficult, and I don't think I can ever remember a season, and it's quite rare, right, where the circumstances are such that a team has the best car, so a dominant car like McLaren has, there's no real challenger from outside, but also when that happens, that the two drivers are very similarly matched. You know, I remember back in the day when I was at McLaren, we had a great car, but it was Mika Hakkinen and David Coulthard, and just naturally Mika Hakkinen ended up being the more dominant driver. So we never had the challenge of balancing the two drivers' situations. McLaren have that right now, and I can't think of a situation when that's happened and it hasn't ended in tears. It happened with Lewis Hamilton and Fernando Alonso with us at McLaren in 2007. It's happened at Mercedes with Nico Rosberg and Lewis Hamilton. Senna and Prost, if you go even further back, there are multiple scenarios where drivers have fallen out because the one guy standing in the way of the biggest prize that they've dreamt of since they were a kid is on the other side of their own garage. That's a really difficult thing to manage. And the answer, I don't think there is a clear answer because no one's done this yet, but I think the only thing you can do in the same way that I'm sure you do with your toddlers, and I've tried to do with my twins, is to make sure they know that there is no preferential treatment. It's about being transparent. It's about being open in terms of race strategy, in terms of the upgrades to a car. And that means, you know, so on occasions, you'll rush through an upgrade because you know it's going to bring performance to the car. And there might only be time to produce enough components that you can only give them to one driver on a particular race. Well, I know that McLaren won't do that this season. They'll maybe wait an extra race until they have enough components for both drivers before they give them to them, because that's how they set the precedent of making sure that both drivers do feel equal, they're getting equal treatment, and that they both have the same opportunities over the course of a race season to win a championship. I think that's the only way you can approach this. Even having said all of that, and McLaren have learned a lot of lessons from years that have gone by, they're doing things quite well at the moment, I think. There's still a very high risk these two drivers will fall out at some point this season.
So who's the A1? If you had to choose one.
Yeah, it's an impossible question to answer. But that's also partly why we're in such a great season, right? Because if there was one that was the obviously dominant driver, this season wouldn't have much intrigue left, would it? Because we know that one's going to come out on top and you sort of switch off. The fact that we don't know that. I mean, Oscar Piastri right now is the guy with the form. He's got the points advantage, albeit only a small one. But he's this young character who's so calm and level-headed, doesn't seem to be fazed by pressure in many regards. And that will stand him in great stead as we go through a season. Supremely talented, particularly under pressure in qualifying. You know, he's outperforming Lando in qualifying at the moment. Lando has a little bit more experience. And in the course of a long championship season, he's already fought for a championship last year. And albeit he didn't win it, and it was a sort of half fight for a championship, he's got some experience in that regard that Oscar doesn't have. And so they both have different strengths and weaknesses. Behind the wheel of the car, they're both extraordinarily good. I think you can say that this current McLaren has suited Oscar Piastri over the one lap in qualifying. He's getting the best out of it there. But in race situations, I think Lando's equally as good and on some occasions better. So you can't split them. So I'm not just sitting on the fence. But I think that's literally the situation we're in Formula One this year. And I think it's great.
You've seen, obviously, the balance of Lewis Hamilton's career. What's his future in the sport? He was, you know, so close to winning a couple years ago, and some feel that you know, maybe to manufacture more drama for Drive to Survive, it was stolen from him. But either way, it just doesn't seem right to see him, you know, fighting for P6, P7. This nature of his career, given everything he's accomplished, what's your appraisal of what he is in the sport moving forward?
Well, first of all, I think he's a hugely inspirational character. I mean, I was lucky enough to work with him in his first couple of years in the sport. He was, and still is, I think, amazingly impressive. And to see him up close and personal and work with him and get to know him a little bit, I've seen so many character traits with him where I could have never predicted what he was going to go on to achieve. But I can look back now with hindsight and say, look, the work ethic, the attention to detail, the looking for advantages, no matter how small, in all areas, those are all things that have meant he's gone on to be the greatest driver this sport's ever seen. In 2021, I don't think it was manufactured for drama in for Netflix, but I do think it was a series of mistakes by the officials that did rob him of a championship. And we should be, you know, this is no disrespect for Max Verstappen, because he took advantage of a situation that was in no way his fault. He did exactly the right thing in that scenario. But, you know, Lewis has every right to feel hard done by. Moving forward, I think Lewis sees an opportunity, as a lot of drivers do in 2026, when there's a huge change coming, massive technical change to the cars and to the sport. And it provides an opportunity for anyone who gets it right. Now, there's a huge transition to make when you switch from one team to another, a massive amount of adaptation, both to the car, how the team works, the people you work with. It's huge. It should not be underestimated. Lewis is in that process right now. In 2026, if Ferrari can come up with a car that's competitive under these new rules, I firmly believe there's no reason why we can't see a Lewis Hamilton fighting for an eighth world championship. He has all of the ability, all of the skill still there. We saw that in wherever it was, China, where he won the sprint race earlier this year. He's got it, still got it. And I know that he's still working probably harder than most people on the grid to find those little opportunities that he was doing 20 years ago when he first came into this sport. He's got everything in place for when he gets the right car, and it could be in 2026 that happens.
The sport has grown, not just in North America. It's obviously, there's massive interest, and there's interest to consume, but also to host races. It means increased travel for certainly the teams. Also, I think some of the historical, races might be, under threat, because there can only be so many dates. I fear for a race like the Montreal Grand Prix moving forward. What do you think in terms of the literal expansion of the sport? What rate is the growth healthy, and what might be some of the unintended consequences?
Yeah, so it's an ongoing question. The success of the sport, I mean, it's almost a victim of its own success, isn't it? It's grown so big and so quickly under the leadership of Liberty Media. They're expanding into new markets, and there's more demand than they can possibly fulfill. There are more places that want to host races than we can fit into a calendar, which is a good problem to have, but it's also a challenge, because a lot of the sort of traditional races, and Montreal is definitely one of those, feel like there's a challenge or a threat coming from new money, if you like, new parts of the world that are able to throw huge sums of money. And we see that from the Middle East and beyond, where new races are happening. I would say, though, I know that the sport, the leadership of Formula One, are very keen to maintain a balance between the modern Grand Prix and the different sort of street races and city centre events that are springing onto the calendar with some of the more traditional old school tracks. We have to maintain a link to this sport's history, and it has a huge amount of really impressive and iconic history. And there are some great racetracks on the calendar, and Montreal is one of those. Not just the track, but a whole city embraces this event. You know, every time I come here to Montreal, I'm blown away by how the whole city's got checkered flags up and down every street. The restaurants and bars are putting on their own little mini events. It's almost like a big street festival that happens over the course of this week. And I can tell you from, you know, spending my life on the road with Formula One, not every racetrack does that. Not every, you know, country does that. Melbourne does it very well. But Montreal, hugely popular in amongst everyone who works in this sport for that reason. So it always comes down to money at the end of the day. It's a huge business. But I think Formula One has a desire to keep some of the more traditional racetracks on the calendar. The challenge is going to be, how do we fit them all in? And it may be that we move to a model over the coming years where we start rotating racetracks, go to somewhere one year, go to somewhere else the year after, and then come back. That's a model that's already being explored in Europe. But to come back to your question of unintended consequences, we're at 24 races right now. I think that's about your limit. You know, the regulations actually allow for 25, but I think you'd find there'd be uproar in amongst the teams and the drivers and the people involved in this sport if we pushed another race into the calendar, because this is a human sport. You know, it's a very technologically driven sport, but it's only driven by humans. You know, thousands of humans up and down this paddock who have to travel and sacrifice time at home with family. You know, I've done that myself. I did it for 10 years. And one of the reasons I ended up leaving the team was because I didn't want to do that forever. Not many people can commit to that forever. So we have to, you know, understand that there's a human element to this. The solution to that, and lots of teams are now exploring this, is that not everybody in every team does every race. And that's a potential solution, but it doesn't work for everybody. So teams now rotate some of the mechanics and engineering crew, the marketing crews. They don't do every Grand Prix now. So they might do 18 or 20, a much more manageable number. And I always feel like when people hear me say these things, a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, will be saying, well, stop moaning. It's an amazing thing. I'd love to be part of that myself. And I totally get that. And I would never complain about working in this sport. But there's always got to be an understanding that you can only push any human so far, even if you're giving them a job that is unbelievably good, a privilege, and all the other things that come with working this sport. There's still a human limit to what we can, you know, fulfill over the course of a year, over the course of a season. And Formula One is coming round to the idea of that's an important factor. So I don't think we're going to expand more than 24. And I do think this idea of rotating staff and potentially even rotating racetracks is going to become more and more common as we move forward.
I want to finish up on the human element that you mentioned. And because I'm a millennial, I get all of my advice from Instagram. And I saw a post that said, your boss will have a bigger impact on your mental health than your therapist, which made me think. And I was like, yeah, it's probably true. When it comes to F1, whether that alpha on the team is the owner or the team principal or the number one driver, how can we make sure that that leadership and that drive for success is done in a way that considers the human element? And what are ways that maybe some of the things that have been done to safeguard that can be transferable to our general businesses?
Well, one of the things that I said on stage this morning at the Explorance World conference here was that what we do in Formula One teams is we look at everything through a lens of performance. Ultimately, what matters to us is performance. But if you look at, you know, human well-being, the well-being of our staff, the sort of fitness and health and mental health of our staff, they all have a knock-on impact to our performance. So if we say performance is what really matters, and in a Formula One team, we go into every detail that contributes to that performance, health, well-being, fitness, you know, preventing injuries, just generally looking after our people has to be one of the most important elements that's going to contribute. So in days gone by, we would have looked at things like HR as a function of a business, even sometimes finance, health and safety. We'd look at those functions as being perhaps a little bit dull, a little bit boring. And sometimes the thing that's often restrictive, you know, we want to achieve something, it's HR or it's health and safety that are often holding us back. In a Formula One team, we flip that and we use those functions, those business functions, as measures of performance. So if somebody injures themselves at work, if someone has a mental health episode or a breakdown, that's terrible for the individual, but it's also a knock-on negative impact to our performance. So if we want to maximize our performance, we have to take those things seriously. So it's not really a case of just ticking a box because that's what the modern day tells us we should do as businesses. If you're a business that's striving, you know, for ultimate performance in whatever sector you're in, if you're not looking after your people, you're not getting maximum performance. And it's literally that simple. That's the way we look at everything through Formula One. It's changed the way that we focus on all of those elements of our, the things that used to be fluffy, you know, what we used to call soft skills, right? Particularly Formula One, it's a technical business. We used to put almost all of our energy and resource into making the car go faster. Well, nowadays, I can tell you, we put an enormous amount of resource into making sure the people are in the best place possible, physically, mentally, you know, health, well-being, all of those things, because none of the technical aspects happen without those people operating at the highest possible level. So I think really that, you know, for anybody listening to this, if you've got a boss or you are the boss, flip the way you look at your people as a function of your ultimate performance, not as something that is just there to deliver the product, you know, the technical aspect or the service or whatever, but the actual human beings and they, those soft, fluffy skills that we used to term them are an absolute differentiator when it comes to ultimate performance. If you look at it that way, you will never not take that stuff seriously again.
Well, I hope our listeners definitely do heed that advice and apply it to their lives, their businesses, and their outlook. We have a great now insight and outlook on all things Formula One. So thank you. And I know there's no cheering in the press box, but enjoy McLaren lapping the field.
Thank you very much, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much to Mark Priestley and everyone at Explorance World and for his insight on how we can think like an F1 team and provide some high performance to our daily lives. We're going to take a break. We're actually going to talk about the F1 movie. Myself and Sho were able to screen it here in Toronto. We'll break that down for you next.
My name is Lucille Bryan.
I'm Clifton Bryan.
My grandson is a Sho.
And I'm so happy that you're listening to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
I'm so glad that you had the Sho. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Grandma and Granddad. It is the Going Deep podcast, and we are going to break down F1, the movie, as you heard before the break. Myself and Sho Ali screened it early here in Toronto at the Scotiabank Theater. Sho was my date for the film. It's only in theaters June 27th, filmed for IMAX, and it's a pretty typical story in terms of the plot line, starring, as you at this point well know, Brad Pitt, playing the character of Sonny Hayes, who is a now, I guess, washed up race car driver, was a promising phenom at one point until he had an accident in the 90s that nearly ended his life. And then, of course, 30 years later, after a wild and crazy, nomadic, both racing career and life, he is approached by a former teammate and now owner of a struggling Formula One team to give it one last shot and really hopefully save the team from losing its ownership and moving along. The co-star in the film playing the other driver for said Formula One team, character of Joshua Pierce, is Damson Idris, someone who I was not familiar with before but really loved his work in this film. And naturally, obviously, you're going to put the grizzled veteran driver with this hotshot, young, talented, athletic kid who thinks he knows everything. I think, those very typical storylines were there. But I think there's certainly lots of nuance in that it's happening in the world of Formula One. But also, it, and my biggest takeaway show, was that it literally was immersed in the world of Formula One. This was not like, oh, we're race car drivers, but you know, all the teams are different. The only team that was different was the made-up team that these two characters were on. All of the other teams, Ferrari, Mercedes, Red Bull, McLaren, are part of the film. All of their sponsors were part of the film. So there was great value and coverage for all of those F1 sponsors, both of the teams, but also the individual races as they went through the F1 circuit throughout the film. And the film was a healthy 155 minutes, 2 hours and 35 minutes long. My one takeaway is that it probably could have been 2 hours and not 235. But it was an enjoyable watch that didn't drag. And as I said, I loved the fact that, oh, there's Toto Wolff, and there's Zach Brown with acting lines, and there's Christian Horner. It's not as if these characters were just placed in an F1 setting via AI or a green screen. They literally filmed on track during race days. And I thought that aspect of it was cool.
Yeah, director Joseph Kosinski, the last big thing he did was Top Gun Maverick. And one of the aspects of that film that I think everyone really loved was they would put Tom Cruise and the rest of the actors in like the second seat in like actual fighter planes and send them into the sky with cameras in the cockpit with them, capturing their real reactions as they're like, you know, still miming, I think, pulling back on the throttle and the stick and so on as they pilot these giant pieces of machinery. So I guess Apple TV was like, oh, okay, well, if you're doing that for fighter jets, can you do it for race cars as well, F1 machines? And that's exactly what they did, right? I mean, I think my favorite part of the movie, the performances from Brad Pitt, Damson Idris, Kerry Condon, Javier Bardem, a lot of Oscar either winners or nominees in this movie, not counting Idris, of course, but I got to think, my favorite part, Donovan, was simply seeing the action. Like I think like the best way I can describe this movie is it's like that there was that Gran Turismo, which is like a video game, but there was that Gran Turismo movie that came out, what was it, last year or the year before? And it's actually shockingly similar. It's just you also have Lewis Hamilton and Max Verstappen and Carlos Sainz and all these guys in it as like racer number two and racer number four next to Sonny Hayes and Joshua Pierce, the two characters, right? So, yeah, I think it was really good. It was essentially like watching a real F1 race, except ultimately you were in the middle of the action. Like you got to hear all the communications between the driver and his team. You got to hear the engineers and the mechanics talk to each other. You saw the drama in the pit lane. You got to see things happening off the track as well. You got to see their pre-track, their pre-game, pre-match meetings when they're discussing their strategies, and it's a one-stop race, a two-stop race. I think that was really cool. And I think that's why it will appeal to the hardcore F1 fan, and they also did a really good job at explaining like what hard and soft tires are and what a safety car matters and like heat conditions on a track, why those matter, for example. So I think they do a good job of like, I think, trying to balance the line, thread the needle between appealing to people who have always been F1 fans and people who maybe only became fans because they watched Drive to Survive, which they also like shouted out in the movie, which is kind of funny.
They did, which I was surprised by because you mentioned this is an Apple Studios and Warner Brothers production. And so the fact that they referenced Netflix and by proxy, maybe you can make the argument, oh, they're not referencing Netflix, they're referencing Box to Box, who produces Drive to Survive, but it airs on Netflix. It debuts and is released on Netflix. I thought it was interesting. Top Gun is a great shout. I think, you know, for people to wrap their head around this, this is like if Days of Thunder and Drive to Survive had a baby. That's what you're watching, essentially. You know, you're getting the aspect of the communication, the conversation, as you mentioned, even so much so, and especially, you know, watching it as impressive as a Spaces IMAX, even the almost seasick nature you have seeing the vantage points of the driver in the car and seeing the power and shock and inertia and rattling that goes on, you know, leaning in and out of turns. But you also got a glimpse into everything that happens in between race day in terms of the study, the sim driving, the calculations and changes to the car, the pressure from investors and owners. And so that aspect of it was good, but also it's still a film. And so you have, you know, battling with the past, daddy issues, you know, sexual tension and love interest, right? All of those things that make a widely consumed blockbuster film interesting to the casuals.
There's some movies that you go and see, right? And they're like engineered to be blockbusters. You know what I mean? Like they're engineered to appeal to as many people as humanly possible. And it's funny, I actually hadn't realized until we were actually physically sitting in the seats at Scotiabank Theater that this was produced in part by Jerry Bruckheimer. And like Jerry Bruckheimer's, like every movie this guy has ever made has gone on to be a smash hit, right? I think my, like the favorite way I like to describe this, Donovan, is that I think F1 the movie is like the perfect dad movie. You know what I mean? There's like a genre of like dad movies and dad TV shows that like, is it like essentially like it's like male fantasy, male wish fulfillment, right? Where you like, it's like guys do like the cool, like cool guys do cool things with hot women and fast cars. And they blow stuff up like those kinds of things. This is the perfect dad movie. Like my dad is going to love this movie. My dad does not watch F1 whatsoever. He's going to love this movie because he likes Brad Pitt. He likes Javier Bardem and he likes fast cars, right? And I think like you look at other examples of like dad movies. I mean, Top Gun Maverick, frankly, was another dad movie, and it was easily, I think, the biggest movie of the year when it came out, or at the very least close to it. You have like TV shows like Reacher, for example, right? That also have that like wish fulfillment aspect of it. And I'm not saying that to knock it by any means. I think like those kinds of movies are really fun to see in a packed theater, right? I mean, I think you and I, when we went to the advanced screening, we went to a screening that I think is like full of people. I mean, it was like full of like influencers, first of all, right?
Yeah, so it was a mixed crowd. It was
press,
influencers, and
like F1 fans, I guess.
I believe contest winners.
Okay, yes. And I got to think if you're like entering a contest, I'm sure there are some people who just enter every contest on planet Earth and hope you win. But I got to think there's also a subsection of people that were there that were like specifically fans of F1. Like, and again, like because I'm sure a lot of these people were influencers.
Well, there's people who were wearing F1 paraphernalia is not the right term, but F1 gear, right?
yeah like they looked like they were like they worked for the teams, essentially. Like people all like literally head to toe in like McLaren or Mercedes or whatever other brand of car gear, 1000%. So
Williams Racing.
So I do think the crowd we went to go see it was probably like the best possible crowd. Like no one was on their phones. Everyone was hyper vigilant to like everything that's going on, like the oohs and ahs when cars crash and things explode, right? So I love that kind of that kind of aspect of seeing movies as a communal experience. But to go back to the idea, like I genuinely think this will be as pleasing to as many people as possible. It's like not particularly offensive in any one way. Like it doesn't put down any one like particular team or brand, for example. Like the only team that gets crapped on is this fictional team, Team Apex, essentially. So I think they did a really good job with how they tried to make sure as many people, no matter who you cheer for, whether it's Verstappen or Hamilton or anyone, will respond to it. There was a moment at the very end that made me laugh out loud. Lewis Hamilton was also credited as a producer on this movie, and I believe One of the big decisions they made last minute was to switch Lewis Hamilton out of one of the leading roles. He was going to be like an actor in the movie. And then they like, for whatever reason, Apple decided, you know what, let's get like an actual actor. And I think that's when they brought in Idris, I think. I think Hamilton was supposed to be like the Idris role. And then they were like, nah, you know what, we can't really make it work. We'll get a real actor in here, which is honestly like probably for the best.
So Lewis Hamilton was going to play himself, or he's gonna play a
I think he was gonna play like a young hot driver, essentially.
See, that would have been confusing because every other driver
is themselves,
is playing themselves.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a big part of the reason why they changed it. But he remained on the movie as a producer. But there's a shot at the very end when I forget if it was Sonny or Pierce, but one of the characters was like getting in their car. I think it was Sonny because it was when like the very end, when like in the last like three laps of the final race, and they all pull into the pit lane and all the drivers are standing there looking at each other. And like Lewis Hamilton gives them like the huge stink eye, and people in the theater like genuinely laughed because it kind of looked like he was supposed to be like the villain of that particular scene. Maybe it was just supposed to be a throwaway shot, but I admit that did make me laugh. Because he's so famous, right? Like he's arguably as famous as Brad Pitt, if not more famous than him in some parts of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I would say in the UK, he's definitely more famous than Brad Pitt. You mentioned it being a dad movie. My question to you, is it a mom movie? And part of the rise of F1 in the last 5-6 years has not only been its increased popularity in North America, a big part of it has been its increased popularity among women worldwide. And this is an F1 movie. Like, it's called F1 the movie for a reason. It is a promotional vehicle for the sport.
It's made in collaboration with the FIA.
That's right, yes. It's not as if they just signed away, yeah, you can use our markings and our logos for a price. Like, they are partners in this endeavor. Again, which I find incredibly fascinating because we know they are already partners in a big way with Netflix. So the fact that they have this separate yet different partnership with Apple is intriguing because my mind wanders to, well, will that mean Apple is going to partner in a bigger way? Could we see, as Apple has partnered with leagues in the past, could we see F1, whose rights in different parts of the world are coming up now? Could we see, you know, every race on Apple in the near future? And Netflix is a partner in terms of storytelling and content, and Apple's a partner in terms of live event production. But anyways, I ask in terms of, is this a mom movie? Because certainly there's a huge amount of fandom among women for F1, and we saw it in the theater. So many women there to consume the film and excited to. Brad Pitt is in the film, and so any Brad Pitt film to a certain extent is going to be one that you'd think is going to be interesting for the female audience. Although I went home and my wife, her one question to me about the film was like, well, is like Brad Pitt just being like Brad Pitt and doing Brad Pitt things? I'm like,
kind of, yeah.
I guess, yeah, kind of. Yeah. But I don't want to give too much of a spoiler away, but there is a romantic relationship with a woman on Apex, said made up team, and one of the drivers, the team members. And in general storytelling, yeah, there's going to be this conflict resolution. There's going to be some sexual tension, and the guy is going to get the girl, and then they're going to, you know, make out, and there's going to be fireworks or more. Like, that's just part of the arc of all of these stories. But then I watched this one. I was like, is that going to land in the same way in an era where the rise of women's sports is so high and such a storyline, and the skepticism for some online in terms of how women in sport get their opportunities, keep them, etc. Like, am I overthinking it? Have I watched too many segments of heated debate on shows like The Social and The View and others? Or was this maybe a miss? And, you know, 2 weeks after the film is out, The Ringer is going to write a long-form think piece on how damaging the portrayal of women is in this film.
That's a good question. I will lean on the side of it not mattering ultimately. And this for one critical reason, because it's Brad Pitt who's doing it, right? And the reason I say this is because I think as part of his like movie persona, and then this goes back to what you were talking about, what you were discussing with your wife. Like, is it Brad Pitt doing Brad Pitt things? Yeah, he is doing Brad Pitt things. You know, one of the Brad Pitt things that he does in almost literally every movie he has ever done in the history of time is get with some woman in some movie. That's like a part. And I'm not saying you're wrong in the sense that it was like you didn't like if they had cut that subplot out of the movie, I don't think anything of note would have been lost. Right. That I will say that. Like, I'm not sure it was necessarily a part that we like needed for either his characters or the character he gets with. Right. But we generally have accepted that this is what Brad Pitt does in movies. You expect it, honestly. And you doubly expect it when the character he's playing is some cocky, arrogant, hotshot cowboy who drifts from place to place, racing cars and winning lots of money, right? So I think that's why I don't think you'll see anyone say it. I think it would have been a little more problematic if it was maybe a different character he ends up getting with, not like an extremely qualified character. Now, again, we can have the conversation like, is it... like, does it matter? Does it matter actually more because the person he gets with is extremely qualified and is a leading role in this movie? I don't know. I go back and forth on it. Ultimately, I got to think too. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that the character he gets with is Carrie Condon's character, because it's like pretty telegraphed, right? Right. Like, it's telegraphed from the very beginning. It's
Kate, who's a race engineer for the team.
By the way, like the name of the character was made me laugh also, because like her full name was a name I think you are very familiar with. I don't know if you caught the character's last name as well. The character's name is Kate McKenna.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
I did not even notice that.
Okay. I was like, oh, you didn't react whatsoever to that. Yeah. Like, Carrie Condon plays like an Irish team engineer whose name is Kate McKenna, which I thought was really funny.
See, now
honestly.
I'm offended.
now you view it in a completely different
that's
way.
Right, yeah. But that's so funny. So if it's Brad Pitt, if it's okay, if it was Justin Baldoni, maybe people might be
but
more
put it this way, like if he had hooked up, like, there's a character in which he like stands up for. It's like a younger, I think she's a mechanic or part of the pit team or whatever. I'm not sure what her exact role was, but she was like a much, much, much younger, right? If he had hooked up with that character, that is problematic, right? That is extremely problematic because there's like a power imbalance there, and like, she, like, you know, you can make the argument she's being taken advantage of, but I think like the way they portray this relationship in the movie is they give Carrie Condon's character all of the agency, and she chooses to initiate at the very end, which is why I don't think it's like a huge issue, in addition to the expectations that they kind of both carry.
Right. It's funny because we talked about the fact that F1 is a full on board partner of this film, and I imagine would have some sort of creative license to have input, make changes and whatnot. And I watched a lot of this film through the lens of like, what are you trying to tell me? Like, are you certainly trying to entertain, but are you trying to educate in terms of what the circuit in F1 is really like? And there's an aspect of the dynamics of ownership and the board and those stakeholders and how you finesse, those relationships, which I thought was super interesting and intriguing. But in terms of, you know, that romance piece, is like, are you saying that this is something that is likely, that it happens, that it's part of the culture of F1? And the other aspect that left me a little bit surprised, knowing that F1 is a partner, is because there were real, depending on what you believe and who you believe, many believe credible, you know, somewhat substantiated allegations against Christian Horner. That, you know, were investigated and at a time threatened his spot within Red Bull. Mind you, based off of the timeline of filmmaking, it may not have lined up at the exact same time, but I'm just from the school of somewhere some lawyer is going to be like, yeah, we should take that out, right? And so I'm surprised that it made it in the film. And we shall see how the public perceives it and reacts to it. But ultimately, You know, I'm giving two thumb emojis up to the film. Really enjoyed it. It
was so out of five, like what does two thumb emojis translate to, like out of five or out of 10, depending on what scale you want to use?
I don't think it's hyperbolic to give it a five.
Wow. Okay.
Like it's a entertaining.
It's pretty high.
Watch. Is it? I put it this way. I would watch it again.
Okay.
Which I would not say for many pieces of content. Period. Never mind full films. But no, I would highly recommend it. It was a good, entertaining watch. It did its job, and I think to a certain extent lived up to the hype. What about you?
Yeah, I think I would give it a four. And really the only reason I ding it is because I think the one, it's, and this is not like a half criticism if I'm being completely honest, but I think the truth is, and it's not something I think this, it's only unique to F1, but I think we've seen all the possible endings for all possible sports movies at this point.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like it, especially when like the result, like the outcome of a sports game, match, race, whatever, is you win or you don't win,
yes,
right?
Binary.
Yeah, you can only have one of those. And they learn a couple of lessons along the way, right?
Yeah, sure.
And that is, I think, at its core, what this movie is about. And I won't spoil how it ends at the very least because it's just coming out. But I do think they didn't even like attempt to like reinvent that sports movie wheel, which again, it's not really a complaint. I don't even think I really wanted them to, but because of that, I do think like you're sitting there, right? Like we're sitting there in the theater. I think pretty much everyone in that theater, you're going to be 50-50 on how this movie ends essentially. Right.
So one of two people were going to win the race.
Exactly. So I just guessed before the movie and that's exactly what happened. Right. And I'm not saying that took away from my enjoyment because I think it's well done. It's not really about who wins. It's about the lessons you learn. Right. And I think they do lean into the idea of like redemption and the underdog, but like the underdog feel good dad sports movie we have all seen before. Right. So I think for that reason, it's like a little formulaic, but I don't think that stops it from being like really enjoyable. Certainly. Like I would go see it again. And I would also recommend people go see it in, which we did in IMAX. Because I think IMAX does lend movies like this, and certainly Top Gun. I saw Mission Impossible in IMAX as well. It's, I think, one that I think you could see in the big format too. I think it's like, I think it's more enjoyable when you hear the sounds and you see the visuals on the biggest possible screen. If you wait until it comes out on streaming and you watch it on TV at home on Apple TV, then I'm sure you'll enjoy it just as much. It's just, I personally like seeing these spectacle-ish movies on the biggest possible screen, and it was a lot more enjoyable that way.
No, that's a good point. Listen, the sound design of this film was, I would argue, a character in the film in terms of the sounds of the racetrack, the cars, but also in terms of the music as it was used to play with emotion and set the tone in terms of suspense and mystery and intrigue. So certainly my prediction that you did not ask for, we will have a F1 the movie 2. There will be a sequel.
It was funny at the premiere. So Dammit Maury from Kiss 92.5, who we know obviously, was like the host of the screening.
That's right.
And he made a joke to someone. I don't know if you were sitting down for that. I don't know if you came back in time because you came back kind of like midway through his spiel, but right before the movie started. And like Maury said something about like, if they make a sequel, they could call it F2. And then some guy in the crowd was like, actually, that exists, which I like. Yeah. I laughed about because it's true. Like, if you, that would like be the logical name right for a sequel. But sorry, if that's like a real thing, you can't do that. No, you can't call it that.
But maybe they'll have a sequel that is about F2 or the Academy or another aspect of racing. I think more likely they'll have a sequel where Brad Pitt is back as a team principal.
Yeah.
And you know, his protege now is the racer that everyone thought he would be. I see this essentially going in the direction of, this is going to be the auto racing version of Creed, where we're going to continue to, you know, pop in on these characters every 3 to 5 years.
I'd enjoy that.
And,
I'd watch,
you know,
that.
Where they are in life and whatnot, like, which, again, I would be down for.
They would just have to create, like, a bad guy character then, because they're racing against real people. Like, unless Max Verstappen's like, I'll be the bad guy. Like, and I mean, and I think you would enjoy it more if, like, a real actor was doing it instead of like just an athlete, for example, which I think you could get away with, certainly.
Yeah, whoever takes the seat from Sonny, that second seat on Apex, that could be the bad guy, theoretically. I mean, there's room for bad guys, whether it's, you know, some angel investor or, you know, a rival team principal. I think they could figure that out. Or someone in the characters' lives.
Sure, yeah.
That reappears for whatever reason. But, hey, you're going to need a consulting fee from us, Lewis Hamilton and Jerry Bruckheimer. We're giving you too many ideas. But it is a good watch. Go see it. Show said wait till streaming. Go see it in IMAX if you can. It is worth the time, and it's certainly worth the money. Hopefully this was worth the time. It cost you no money, so thank you for listening. Please like, favorite, share, and subscribe. It's the least you could do because it cost you no money. We've got some real good episodes coming up for you. Some thematic episodes as well. Like this one was tailored, obviously, to F1. So stay locked for that. And thanks for listening.